Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Rhode Island Senator and Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse is with us, and there are several important things to talk about with him. One, he's got an impassioned new book out about the corrosive influence of corporate money on American politics. The book is called Captured, The Corporate Infiltration of American Democracy. And Senator Whitehouse is on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and today the committee heard more testimony from FBI Director James Comey on Russian meddling in the presidential election. Comey told the committee that Russia represents, quote, the greatest threat of any nation on earth, given their intention and capability. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna. Terrific of you to have me.
So I promise you we will talk about the book. But I just wanted to start off with what you heard from James Comey today. Just your reaction to the testimony he gave the Judiciary Committee.
Well, a great deal of it was trying to fend off inquiries into ongoing investigations. I've been Rhode Island's attorney general, and I was the U.S. attorney for the state as well. So I appreciate what he had to do with those questions. He also did his best to try to convince everybody that in the disparity between the very public way in which he treated the Hillary Clinton email investigation versus the very confidential way in which he treated the Trump campaign Russia influence investigation, he was trying to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was not as convincing on that point.
Well, so let's just listen to a little bit of tape here. This is FBI Director James Comey again today speaking before the Senate Judiciary Committee, defending his decision to notify Congress that he had reopened the FBI probe into Hillary Clinton's emails less than 2 weeks before the election.
It makes me mildly nauseous to think that we might have had some impact on the election. But honestly, it wouldn't change the decision. Everybody who disagrees with me has to come back to October 28th with me and stare at this and tell me what you would do. Would you speak or would you conceal? And I could be wrong, but we honestly made a decision between those two choices that even in hindsight, and this has been one of the world's most painful experiences, I would make the same decision.
Senator Whitehouse, you said you didn't find Director Comey terribly convincing on this matter. Was he questioned about why he chose not to speak about the fact that the FBI had an ongoing investigation into the Trump campaign?
Yes. And in the same way, he said that it's the ordinary rule that people don't talk about ongoing criminal investigations. I think his original sin was back when they decided not to file any charges against Secretary Clinton. He should have just ended the press conference there. Instead, he went on a lengthy, added discussion about her email behavior. That is what we call derogatory investigative information. If you don't charge somebody, you do not release derogatory investigative information. I think he made a terrible mistake going on after announcing the decision not to charge her with anything. And once he'd released that extra information, now Congress had something to ask him about. So it was hard for him to say no. So now he ends up dragged up in front of Congress. And then at the end of that, he answers a question, will you let us know if anything changes? So now he's stuck with that answer. And then they get into Anthony Weiner's laptop and he feels obliged to volunteer investigative information because of what he said to Congress, which he would never have had to have said if he'd simply followed the rules in the first place.
Right.
So I think this is a big exercise in trying to make himself feel better about a Bill Bruckner-type error that he made at the get-go.
Yeah. Well, I want to play one more piece of tape here, again, from the Judiciary Committee meeting today. And this is, in fact, you questioning Comey. And in a way, it links the FBI and James Comey and the Russia investigations to the broader issue of money in politics that you write about in your new book. So this happened today. This is you, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, asking Comey about shell corporations and their potential effect on American democracy.
Is it true that shell corporations are often used as a device for criminal money laundering?
Yes.
Is it true that shell corporations are also often used as a device for the concealment of criminally garnered funds?
Yes.
And to avoid legitimate taxation?
Yes.
what do you think the hazards are for the United States with respect to election interference of continuing to maintain a system in which shell corporations that you never know who's really behind them are commonplace?
I suppose one risk is that it makes it easier for illicit money to make its way into a political environment.
And that's not a good thing.
I don't think it is.
Yeah, me neither.
Senator Whitehouse, why did you want to ask James Comey about that?
Because I support legislation to require corporations, when they are formed in the states, to disclose who their true, what's called beneficial owner is. We've had a lot of problems with foreign criminals coming to the United States to hide money in shell corporations. The European Union is cleaning up its act right now in that area, and that means that there'll be more pressure from international criminals to come to the United States to hide money behind shell corporations. Of course, once you have a shell corporation set up, you don't necessarily just have to hide money in it. You can use it to hide your hand in seeking political influence. And because of the role of dark money, and because the Supreme Court misguidedly said anybody could spend unlimited money, that opens an absolute avenue for foreign political interference in our elections.
Right. So you're referring to the Citizens United case from 2010.
Yep, I sure am.
Yeah. So let's talk about that bigger issue about money in American politics, because that's what you write about front and center in your book, Captured, the Corporate Infiltration of American Democracy. And it's interesting because in the book, you basically put forward this idea that you don't actually think government itself is broken, but rather, if we're seeing the slow degradation of the ideal of American democracy, it's because of the corrosive influence of money, right?
Yeah, I think we've got to learn as citizens to distinguish between the host and the virus. And the reason that the host is misbehaving is because it's infected by a virus, and the virus is enormous floods of often hidden corporate money, and right behind them, the threats that that capability empowers. You don't have to spend the money if you can. You can just threaten somebody.
Right. Now, you write about how, again, Citizens United was ruled on by the Supreme Court in 2010, and that in the years prior to that, there was, regarding climate change specifically,
yeah,
there was a
oh, yeah,
really different feel in the Senate than after 2010. What was it like before Citizens United?
Before Citizens United, I sat on the Environment and Public Works Committee, and we were constantly holding hearings and debating climate change. There was a constant flow of Republican-sponsored bills to find various ways to limit carbon emissions. John McCain ran for president carrying the Republican banner with a really strong climate platform, and it was what you'd expect. It's a big issue. Did we get it right away? Of course not. But there was work being done. There were hearings being done. There were compromises being worked out. There was progress going forward. Mm-hmm. January 2010 comes Citizens United. The fossil fuel industry asked for that result, expected that result, and immediately put the new artillery that Citizens United gave them to work. And from that day forward, there has not been a single piece of Republican co-sponsored legislation to restrict carbon dioxide emissions.
It stopped
as dead as a flat line on an EKG.
And the effect was that immediate. I mean, you in the book you write about how you see concerted efforts, organized efforts to, in a sort of stepwise system, to deny the science that exists, question
yep.
motives, and then exaggerate the costs of solutions here. How have you seen that play out in Washington?
Well, it gives a lot of talking points for people who come and lobby. It provides a way to fool the American public. And the fossil fuel industry goes to really extraordinary lengths to create front groups and screens so that their own hand isn't seen in this work. And it creates an environment in which there is less of a public feeling of urgency to get anything done. And then when you combine that with the unlimited political spending and the capability to threaten unlimited political spending on the election side, now a Republican senator is getting it from both sides. Mm. They have a public that is not demanding much of them, and they have an industry that's saying, hey, cross us on this and you're finished.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, though, because, yes, Citizens United did open the floodgates for unlimited amounts of corporate money to enter the political system. But we were headed this direction for quite some time anyway. I mean, we were looking back at numbers of in terms of campaign donations from the financial sector to both Democrats and Republicans. And ironically, before 2010, the financial sector gave in effect more money to Democrats than it did to Republicans. So, I mean, it was what I'm wondering is, we could have seen this coming, right? Because money has been playing a role in politics for a long time.
The role of money in politics has been is as old as politics. So that's always been the case. In those days, you usually saw the money show up in the form of a $10,000 PAC check or a CEO hosting a $100,000 fundraiser for somebody. And all of that would be reported and on the record. And every advertisement that you saw said, I'm Sheldon Whitehouse and I approve this message, mm-hmm. or I'm Elizabeth Warren and I approve this message, or, you know, whoever the sponsor of the ad was and I approve this message. Now you have unlimited amounts of money, which allows these threats to take place. You have phony organizations putting the ads up. I make fun of, you know, imaginary groups with names like Rhode Islanders for Puppies and Prosperity that are suddenly running huge numbers of ads on the TV, slamming somebody, and everybody watching that ad knows that that is not a real group and that this is weird. And then there's the dark money where you don't actually know who's behind it. And those things are all new and they are all different and they all empower a very, very small section of the population, which is big industries who have such a big stake in Washington that it's worth their while to spend that kind of money. And the regular folks or businesses for whom that is not the situation get rolled and get ignored as a result.
Yeah. I'm wondering, though, sometimes I try to take the long view of history here, and I can't help but to wonder if, in a way, where we are now was inevitable because, I don't know, at least for 30, 40 years, maybe even more than that, we've been hearing constantly about the primacy of the free market, the infallibility of American businesses, the idea that all solutions, it's sacrosanct. American business is sacrosanct. And so
what's good for GM is good for America.
Right. That's kind of been an animating force in terms of how we even view the country. So for that to filter into politics seems almost inevitable. And it just sort of came to a head in 2010 in Citizens United.
Well, the really big difference is that for people who believe that corporations kind of have a better sense of where to guide America than regular Americans do, that's fine. And if they were standing up and saying, we are ExxonMobil, and this is our point of view, and we approve this ad, that would be one thing. What's sneaky and really challenging after Citizens United has allowed all this money to pour in is the ways that they found to pour it in, including through front groups, so that the citizen watching the advertisement doesn't actually know that it's ExxonMobil or the Koch brothers or whomever it is behind the advertisement. And then, of course, if you have the ability to threaten to spend to spend that kind of money, you necessarily have the ability to make the threat mm-hmm. to spend that kind of money. And as somebody who spent a lot of time in prosecution work, you allow that kind of power, you are going to create corruption, because that is always going to be a quiet side deal with somebody telling somebody else in some dark corner, don't you cross us on this. We can put $5 million against you in the next election. You won't know where it came from. You'll never see it coming. We need you to get right on this, and we need you to get right on this right now. And that is a conversation that is, I think, empowered by Citizens United and deeply corrupting of our politics.
It makes me wonder if someone ought to bring a suit against Citizens United or file some kind of legislation saying that, you know, if the mere threat of millions of dollars pouring into a reelection effort can produce a chilling effect on how a politician operates or what he or she says. Is that not an infringement of that politician's First Amendment rights? I mean, is it too far to say that? Because it's a First Amendment question that brought Citizens United to the Supreme Court to begin with.
Yeah, well, the theory is that money is speech and that therefore unlimited amounts of money have to pour into politics because you can't regulate money any more than you can regulate speech.
I mean, but what you're saying is
that... The problem with that is that you can actually regulate speech in this context. If you're, you know, committing fraud, you can be prosecuted. If you're libeling somebody, you can be sued. If you're yelling fire in a crowded theater, that's not legal either. So it's a terrible argument that the First Amendment controls and dictates that unlimited spending by big, powerful industrial interests is mandated by the Constitution.
It's hard to think about hard to feel optimistic, Senator, to be perfectly honest, because, I mean, is the genie just out of the bottle here? Can we get it back in?
I think we can get it back in. First of all, the public hates the Citizens United decision. Republicans hate it. Democrats hate it. The public hates it. It's only good for a small group of very big dollar influencers who have the ability to take advantage of it.
But they have outsized influence, as we've been talking about.
Yeah, and it's been expanded by this in kind of a weird circularity. So they've been able to shut down things like disclosure requirements so you can actually see who's behind the ad, which we still could do in Congress. But ultimately, I think the Supreme Court is going to learn that they made a terrible mistake and they'll have to correct it themselves, and that Citizens United will go into the ash bin of history along with the Lochner decision and the Plessy decision and some of the other colossal train wrecks.
Senator, let me just jump in here because you mentioned the Supreme Court again, and I have to play a piece of tape from the nomination or the confirmation hearings for now Justice Neil Gorsuch, because you asked him why, again, these are during his confirmation hearings, why a group of millionaires and billionaires spent millions of dollars to stop Merrick Garland's nomination and spent millions of dollars in support of now Justice Gorsuch. Here's that moment.
The dark money group that is spending money on your election spent at least $7 million against him getting a hearing and a confirmation here, and indeed produced that result by spending that money. And then now we have $10 million going the other way. That's a $17 million delta. And for the life of me, I'm trying to figure out what they see in you that makes that $17 million delta worth their spending. Do you have any answer to that?
You'd have to ask them.
I can't because I don't know who they are. Mm-hmm. It's just a front group.
An amazing moment, Senator, to be perfectly honest.
It kind of illustrated the point, didn't it?
Yeah. So we just
have... The fact, just one other thing
sure.
on this, the fact that this is sloshed over from elected politics for the president and elected politics for Congress to trying to influence confirmation hearings and control appointments to the Supreme Court, that's another pretty grim step.
Absolutely. And we haven't even talked about the effect that it has on state and local politics as well. But we have just under a minute to go. And I do want to ask you, because I'm always grasping for solutions here. I mean, if I understand correctly, what you mentioned earlier, that Congress could, if it wanted, it could legislate a bill that would require disclosure of political contributions by corporations and others. Is there any possibility that that could happen with this Congress?
Hard in this Congress, but because it's hard to find the pressure point to drive the bill forward. But if the House switches hands so that a Democratic speaker can say, OK, let's push this piece of legislation, then things can really start to move. And I think in a couple of years, the American public is going to be so sick of this that the bill will have to move one way or the other.
Well, Sheldon Whitehouse is the Democratic senator from Rhode Island. His book is Captured, The Corporate Infiltration of American Democracy. Senator Whitehouse, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna. I appreciate being on.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.